All right, what do you do back in Beijing? What's going on?
Oh, a few meetings and also heading to Hangzhou end of this week. Have a few meetings in Hangzhou as well. We are planning the second live commerce immersion, but this time in Hangzhou. So I said, since I'm in China, I'm just coming here to meet some of the ecosystem stakeholders first. The MCNs,
the next program.
Yeah, just because the last time we did it, and it actually went pretty well in Shenzhen. And everyone said, okay, this is great. And they of course, from our point of view, we look at how the system, how the programs will run, how the communications were facilitated. I do think there are rooms for improvement, especially in helping people understand each other's context. Because this is actually an issue which is actually quite common, right? I mean, Chinese company, they are talking to sort of foreign counterparts about, you know, experiences and about potential collaboration. But there's lots of context when they say things, right? When they say certain things that everyone understands in China, but it will require an explanation for people outside to understand what they're talking about.
Well, hold on. So before we begin, why don't we just tell the audience the contact? Because I think we haven't talked in a while. So we last talked, you were about to go to this live immersion trip. Is it a new program? I mean, you've done immersion trips before, but I guess it's more of a formalized product now and service.
Yeah.
Before, like about more than a month ago, then I was about to go to my US trip. And so what exactly what happened in the past month and what's the context? And then we could probably dive right in from there.
The context was last year we sort of honored the request of specific companies that we did a few immersions to Guangzhou and Shenzhen. A couple of reasons. First, I mean, some of the leaders wanted to see after pandemic in their specific industries. I mean, e-commerce, logistics, and financial services. What has changed? So, and the second is that especially in e-commerce and logistics, now you see so many Chinese companies coming out and so they become your customers, they become your collaborators, they become your partners, or they become your competitors. So there's quite a bit of trying to understand what's going on. And second is really talking to the leaders of the companies here, trying to establish some kind of communications, because what had happened previously is that, okay, you would have your, I don't know, sales manager or your whoever that's in charge of commercial dealing with their part of the commercial operations. And quite often the style of doing things can be quite different. So just to give you a simple example, I mean, I think most European and Western companies would not do things without a contract. And many Chinese companies would have the style of let's start working first and have some kind of in principle agreement, and then let's just start working before we sort of formalize the thing and go through the process. So for complicated things, I mean, sometimes the contract takes like 4 to 6 months. I mean, back and forth, right? Oh. And the expectation is that during this 4 to 6 months, we can still work together. And this is something that many outside companies are not comfortable about. Mm.
And how do, like, typically in China, parties come to this kind of agreement? Is there like some type of business culture or business ritual that you do to allow you to start working while working at the contract?
No, I think inside China, working on a contract can be quite straightforward, right? I've seen some of the contracts have been sort of drafted, reviewed, signed within like a week. So, okay. but if you think about it, I mean, let's say that, okay, for a e-commerce company going to Europe, European Union, like more than 20 different jurisdictions. And if you want to set up operations in different jurisdictions, to make sure that you have local compliance, make sure that, okay, you have local team and make sure you have the structure and stuff. So quite often checking everything would take a bit of time.
Well, yeah, I guess it's very similar to Southeast Asia. People have this conception that you're going to a region, but you're not. You're going to each individual country pretty much. And so, there's some overlap probably, especially like some macro laws across the countries, but more so for EU, I guess, but less so for Southeast Asia, right? So, I mean, You're right. It's different.
When you think about that, I mean, there are so many advantages of large single market, right? So lots of things that they do it once and you can immediately scale.
Okay. No, because I was just, you're talking about single large markets, right? And I was just saying how I was doing like, this is like my second expo in the US, and it's absolutely true. Like, you just forget what it's like being in a big market and doing business in big markets. Like, all of these small little snack brands have one SKU. They're just all, like, if they're successful, they all end up being $100 million businesses. But like, you just won't see that in Southeast Asia. And yeah, I don't know whether it would be the same in EU or South America or something like this, but it's just, there's, like you said, a lot of huge inherent advantages, and it's like a different mind shifts when you go to, you know, from like Southeast Asia to US. So I don't know what you're seeing from your trips from, you know, Southeast Asia to China. Like, are your participants having that conceptual issue, or what have you seen?
I think, so basically I was saying that we had had a few sort of private immersions for some leaders of specific companies. So this year we said, okay, let's formalize some of the concepts, right? We started with live commerce in March. We had, I think, 21 participants, mostly from Southeast Asia, different countries of Southeast Asia, coming to China to visit companies, exchange with ecosystem stakeholders. And the companies we visited or heard from or spoke to are MCNs, right? Multi-channel networks, AI companies, platforms, and basically other parts of the ecosystem. So what was specifically impressive? Two things. I mean, first is obviously the sort of MCN operations. You know what MCN is, right?
Why don't you explain just in case someone doesn't know?
Okay, it started as a concept for agency which manages different live show or live commerce hosts. So basically, they will sign the talent, and they will train them, manage them, provide the facilities, and brands can hire them to run live operations. But because live commerce grew so fast since 2018 in China, now it's $3 or $4 trillion yuan business last year in China. So
that's huge.
Yeah, it's huge. I mean, the whole e-commerce marketing in Southeast Asia is not that big.
No, but I was just asking, like, so for example, did you run NPS? And like, you know, I'm very curious about the value derived on both sides, you know, for the Southeast Asian participants, what did they get out of this? And then what about the China side? What value did they get out of that?
I think for the Southeast Asian participants, actually it's a diverse group of e-commerce enablers and brands and investors. So people would have different expectations. So e-commerce enablers, many of them are experimenting with live commerce. Obviously, they hope to see how players in China do it, and what kind of technologies they can adopt. What kind of like practices, SOPs in sort of managing the talent, managing the live studios, and also sort of deal with the different parties in the ecosystem. I think from the Chinese point of view, actually, all the companies that we visited have this desire, right? We want to expand outside China and help us in your space. There's this top MCN who sent three people flying from Hangzhou to Shenzhen to meet us, right? And their desire is very, very straightforward. They said, we are one of the largest in China, and we have lots of brands work with us, right? And many of the brands are telling us that, okay, we want to expand into other markets. Now TikTok Shop as an e-commerce platform is available across Southeast Asia and in the US. So this agency, this MCN, they built their own operations in Indonesia. They built their own operations in Thailand. And recently they also built a team in the US. And what they were telling the participants is quite interestingly, he said, it's already a big challenge for us to manage these three countries. Now if our clients are saying that, hey, can you also go to Vietnam? Can you also go to Malaysia?
Yeah.
We don't have the people, we don't have the energy. And now we have dabbled with three markets. We know how complicated it is to manage multiple markets.
Yeah.
So we need partners. But I think looking for partnership is also not that straightforward. I mean, for the issues that I've discussed just now, right? So for instance, they said, okay, I will have this partner, this potential partner. Can we start working first? And they figure out whether we can work together.
Oh, I see.
And we talked that to a non-Chinese company. They said, well, take a step back. Let's understand each other better more before we started actually dedicating some resources.
I mean, it just sounds like you need like some type of framework where both parties can get an easy buy-in, right? Something where per market, there's some type of quick contract. It's kind of like a safe note for like what YC did for early stage, right? So if you have some type of early agreement, that's kind of like a template, and you can kind of copy paste this and both parties are kind of plugged in. Like that'd be great if someone could probably build that. That would help probably facilitate a lot of this learning process, because it's going to be a lot of hit and miss, right? Because either like brands just might not even work here, and then for trying to find a product market fit for what consumer works where, like it's just like so many complicated things that can go wrong, I can see, you know, and I could see why this is like a maybe interesting exercise for both parties. So.
Actually, you're right. I mean, there needs to be some framework that that facilitates some trust, but also allows some flexibility that, okay, while we're trying out each other and we don't get tied into a fixed contract, because a lot of times, we start working together, you don't know how things will go. You can't set all the terms very clearly. I mean, unless you're very straightforward relationship, right? Okay, I'm moving goods and you help me, you know, I don't do the last mile. But otherwise, I mean, something more complicated requiring actually building a sort of expertise operations together. And that's much more complicated.
There's going to be a huge culture clash. Like the way Chinese companies work will not be the same way that companies here in each individual market within Southeast Asia, or even like across regions in the US, right? It's all going to be very, very different probably.
And also what I have realized is that even inside China, I mean, people from different sectors, there can be a big culture clash as well. Within China.
Interesting.
So, so historically, people talk about all this, you know, people who work for MNCs in Shanghai, like the likes of, TNG or all these like large international companies which have China operations, and their style would probably be very different from people who are working for SOEs here in Beijing.
Yeah, of course.
The way of communication, the way of hierarchy, the way of addressing each other, the way of like how the meetings are run, are different.
Interesting.
And recently I spoke a lot with people. I mean, you know, Alibaba is the sort of ditching its offline retail assets. Jules has said that in the earnings call, saying that this is not our core business. We will look to basically, I mean, I can't remember the exact words, but we will basically work to get rid of them. But the market is bad, so it might take a bit of time to get rid of them. So. So I spoke with a lot of people involved in these operations, and they said the Alibaba culture, although, I mean, for outside, you understand as a Chinese, you know, 996, working hard, you kind of stuff.
The basics.
It's very different from the retail culture in China. People run doing retail businesses. I said, what do you mean? They said, e-commerce. Operations, you largely deal with smart people, you deal with systems, you deal with basically something which is technology driven. So the talent you attract, and the system you have built, and the protocols of communications are different from retail. Retail grew very fast in the last two decades, but how did it grow? It grew with store managers. Or large store managers having a very, very strict way of control at their operations. I mean, shouting at people, you know, making sure everyone replied within five seconds and stuff.
Okay, so then where were we? Well, we're talking about cultures, culture clashes within industries in China. Okay, so then what else happened in the month? Or like maybe we should talk about what's happening maybe a quick update in Southeast Asia. What's been going on with Radar? What have you been hearing about? What are you focused on these days outside of your work for Momentum Works and your immersion trips to China?
I have been coming to China a lot last few
very China focused.
last few months, I'm sort of very cross-border focused, I would say, right? I mean, I look at, I mean, this friends from Southeast Asia, when they deal with people in China, and potentially we might want to do something China and Latin America, because just this year alone we hosted I don't know how many companies from Brazil and passing by Singapore and passing by our office, thinking about okay, I want to understand how all these e-commerce companies from China and what they want to do, in Brazil. Why everyone thinks that Mercado Libre is not their competitor? Their competitors are each other.
Can you elaborate on that?
So basically, if you understand the e-commerce landscape in Latin America, especially the southern part of Latin America, you would have, of course, Amazon, which is there, but Amazon is never particularly strong in developing markets.
Yeah.
And you have this player called Mercado Libre, I think coming out of Argentina or Uruguay, I think Argentina. So we started in 1999 and pretty much the same time as Amazon. And they basically built on the Amazon model, right? They have they have the digital mode, they have their own retail, they have, now they are building like, you know, payment and financial services. They have super good logistics in key cities in Southern Latin America. So all the stock analysts that I've spoken who are from that region are very bullish about Mercado Libre, that this is the best company and they've built a very strong moat and they have the logistics, their payment, et cetera, et cetera. But we talk to the Chinese companies. I mean, many of them are there, right? So Shopee is still there. I mean, whether you see it as a Chinese company or not, I mean, culturally, it's actually, I mean, from leadership point of view, it has lots of Chinese elements in it. Shein is there. Last year, I think everybody was imposed a 17% tax for cross-border orders below $50. Everybody kind of complied one way or another. There you have AliExpress, which has been there for a while. TikTok Shop is maybe launching soon, but I don't know when. And Temu is in part of LATAM. So basically all these like large Chinese e-commerce platforms converge in Latin America. And people are saying that, okay, so we talk to leaders from these companies in charge of LATAM business. They will say, our competitor is not Mercado Libre. Our competitor is that Chinese guy over there.
Ah, interesting. Well, they're either not afraid of the local competition or they're just see the outsiders as the enemy, I guess. That's interesting. So, but it sounds like you're building a very interesting product. Like, interesting pain point is that these cross-border pain points. And I think MomentumWorks is kind of sitting in the middle of those and help facilitating the learning. So, and I guess your value capture is by organizing these programs.
At the end of the day, we have been doing a lot of internal reflections at what exactly are we building. And one word which kept coming out of sort of the different kinds of pointers from colleagues is trust, right? Because, when you don't understand each other's context, you don't understand each other's intention. And sometimes you see the other party being, you know, not reasonable, aggressive, but sometimes it just, they come out of a different culture. This is what, I mean, it's expected out of their normal business culture there. It goes both ways, right? I mean, between the Chinese party and the other countries. But it gets more complicated when all these Chinese companies are trying to run multi-country operations, or all these sort of Chinese brands are trying to find, I mean, partners in multiple countries. I mean, it took like American and Japanese companies like one decade, two decades in the 1980s, 1990s to build local partnerships, to build distribution. But many Chinese companies, they just came out like the last few years. They probably don't have that learning yet. And they're going through it. And typically they came in with a very impatient mindset. So sometimes, I mean, of course it's good to sort of be a little bit faster compared to what, the normal business culture you see in other countries, but sometimes it's too detached from reality.
Yeah. So if you say to project this on like a 10-year, 15-year scale, what does that look like for Chinese companies looking to expand, or what does it mean for the other regional or other regions, I should say, where companies have to interact with these Chinese companies looking to go out? Or does, or conversely, does this also mean there's a lot more channels being developed for people to get into China as well? What do you think in that kind of time frame?
I think I'm not sure if you listen to Zhu Cai's interview with the Norwegian Sovereign Fund. It's on YouTube. But he has one point which I fully agree. Right? I mean, China is still a huge single market, so a lot of the things will still happen in China. All the executives you talk to, right? They said, I mean, if the domestic market was not so competitive, I would not look at, you know, trying to expand into other markets, because we know that, okay, it's perilous, right? I mean, it's not like 5-6 years ago, people from the internet industry in China were saying that, we have the best business model in the world, we can conquer the world. I mean, many of them learned their lessons. It's not that easy.
Yeah.
There's lots of risks, and it's actually for business models which require you to build a large local presence and have the assets. So people's sense of risk, I think it's quite acute now. So the question is that, I mean, how exactly will all these things play out, right? I mean, I do think that there are a few factors which will impact. And first, obviously, is the domestic economic performance in China.
Yeah.
So if everybody has a business to run, money to earn inside China, I don't think they'll bother going outside, right?
Interesting.
And second is the politics and geopolitics. So politics, I mean, the policies in China towards certain industries, and the geopolitics means that, I mean, some of the players which have, like, you know, supplier or customer relationships with Western companies, when some of the complexities, I mean, tariffs and stuff, or sort of heightened inspections are introduced, so some of them might be forced to relocate their assembly and production in places like Vietnam and Cambodia. I think another factor is related to politics and geopolitics is we have all these companies trying to expand into markets, and of course you have some bad apples, right?
Yeah.
And which will create incidents, which will change the perception that people have about Chinese companies as a whole, right? So this is something that that probably, I mean, the sort of legit businesses who try to build global markets for the long term are concerned about. Just to give you an example, I mean, TikTok Shop has started to become strict for lots of Chinese sellers on their platforms, right? Because they know that, okay, if you can't run a situation where you are dominated by only Chinese sellers.
If you're going global, yeah.
If you're going global, it's the same reason why Amazon started all these platform rules, right? I mean, in the end, you want to make sure that everyone competes on the same field, and as a referee, I'm impartial so that the rules are clear.
Yeah, well, Amazon's been accused lately of taking everyone's margin, right? I saw this article where some guy had a top line of 20 million, but he had zero profit. So this is more monopolistic problems from the U.S. perspective, but no, going off tangent.
I would also think that sometimes, right? I mean, we have large companies, you set up something which with a good intention, but quite often what happens is that, you have like different teams within your company executing on these good intentions, and these people have different KPIs, and sometimes that might not exactly eventually align with the long-term health. I mean, we're being wrong.
I believe the argument is that, Bezos was very masterful and it was very purposeful. You know, the goal was to take as much margin as possible, but yeah, maybe it's to the point where it cut to be unhealthy, very similar to how like food delivery platforms, you know, started in Asia where, you know, you have like a nice margin of 20% that goes up to 30, and then, you know, you overreach and start charging 40-50%. It doesn't make sense for your customers anymore on the marketplace, right? So yeah, it's just a natural evolution.
And quite often when you run a platform business, exactly whose side are you on, right? Because you heard about the what Joe Tsai mentioned about Alibaba having stepped on its own foot, made some mistakes. And he said the mistake they made was they forgot who their customers are. This for me is very interesting because historically Alibaba has never focused on users. I mean, the consumers, they have always been a business focused platform, right? I mean, make it easy to do business everywhere and help businesses discover clients. But if you redefine your focus as users, I mean, it might seem like, okay, it's, I mean, what's the big deal of it? But we have, I don't know, like 200,000 people executing on that vision. And sometimes when there's conflict between the consumer and the merchant, what do you do? So some of the policies they did recently on Taobao, including, I think you might have heard of it. So consumers can ask for a refund without returning the goods.
Okay, interesting. That's very different than the Amazon model.
Yeah, this is something that Pinduoduo has been running for a while.
Interesting. I guess it makes sense specific to the market, though. They probably, like, we experienced it early when we built e-commerce early in Southeast Asia, like returns were 30 to 50%. It was like insane in the early days, right? So I could see, like, if that's a persistent problem, you probably have to address it differently for your market. So, I mean, does that work for China? Like,
I think for Pinduoduo, there's a couple of reasons, right? I mean, first, this is being used as a lever to force the merchants to not screw up, right?
Yeah.
Because if you screw up, you might not get paid. And does this policy hurt some legitimate merchants who
probably
but at a policy level, I mean, it's very hard for you to sort of
have
different rules for different people, right?
I mean, in theory, that's going to be probably someone's new margin for a new business. But yeah, on a macro scale where we are, you know, where you're aggregating value in one platform, it's in the short to medium term, it probably doesn't make sense.
Then there's one thing I suspect, I don't have empirical data on this, is that we have that policy, you probably save, I don't know, a few thousand headcounts or customer service.
Yeah, for sure. Sure. I definitely agree with that. And I mean, that's every organization's goal is to reduce the customer headcount, contacts per agent, right? And all this kind of stuff. So I have one final question for you then. So if you're, because we talked about geopolitics, and I've come across this, especially when my portfolio companies talking to other people, especially in the tech space. There is a geopolitical line, right? So especially if you're doing tech or, you know, deep tech, if you're starting like a new, say, AI company today, where should you base your company? Because one of my founders I was talking to, he's thinking about wanting to live in Taiwan or wanting to live like in, say, Berkeley, California. Yeah. And those have two hugely different implications. Of course, it depends on your customer base and where you can sell. But say if you have equally big niches or markets, say within the China sphere or the North Asia sphere, or then you also have an equally compelling customer base in, say, the US sphere, what would you advise to someone looking at this kind of problem, given the geopolitics?
No, I think I think each person's industry is probably different. So the circumstances and the challenges and restrictions are probably different. If you ask for advice, I would probably say two things. I mean, first is that I think for geopolitics, understand deeper what exactly is happening, what's the undercurrent. And what are the things that you can influence? What are the things that that's just a trend that you know is going to happen? It's happening slowly, but it's going to happen. And regardless of how much effort you make.
Yeah.
So understanding that, understanding the intentions of the large players, political players, nation state players, and you will get a better sense about where you should plan and allocate your resources. And the second is that I still see Singapore as a good location for that.
For both worlds.
Yes, there will be a succession of premiership next month.
Yeah,
but probably will go very smooth because I think
you're talking about Singapore.
Yes, the Prime Minister is staying on. So I mean, staying.
Oh, he's staying on.
Senior Minister, or I mean, he's staying on in the cabinet.
Okay. But they're changing the actual role. Yeah.
Yeah, he's not the prime minister anymore, but yeah. He'll probably be doing something similar to what Lee Kuan Yew did.
Lee Kuan Yew, yeah. That's the Lee Kuan Yew move.
Yeah. Yeah, Lee Kuan Yew stayed in the cabinet for like what?
A long time.
20 plus years after yeah. he left
right.
the premiership. And of course, we can you have different kinds of arguments to see what is good or what is bad. But having that guy actually in the cabinet probably gives investors a lot of assurance during the transition period, however long that transition period is.
Is that a hack? Like, say if you're based in Singapore, would you be able to attract Western and Chinese capital, or is it just better to accept one capital from one side? I should only accept capital from, say, like China versus, say, US, and I will only focus my customer base on either side. I imagine raising funds is very different. We're in a very different environment today. So final thoughts on this.
I think if you have only one choice, I would say that accept the US funding source.
Okay.
I don't think there's any ambiguity towards that, because at the end of the day, the IPO market, the secondary market, and the whole ecosystem in the US is much more mature compared to that of China.
Yeah, unless you have a very specific probably China product or probably you're solving for that kind of base, I guess. Yeah, but that makes sense.
Fake.
So
yeah.
Okay. Any final thoughts before moving out? Maybe anything looking ahead or any other interesting topics for the future?
I can probably come back to you. I mean, I'll be in Hangzhou Monday to Wednesday. So I'll be meeting lots of friends there. So I can probably talk to you afterwards about, because
okay.
Hangzhou is a live commerce capital of the world in a way. And somebody did the calculation that every 244 residents of Hangzhou, one of them is involved in live commerce.
Wow.
No, one of them is live actually. So, and now you see that, everybody's going to live, right? JD's founder, Richard Liu, and he started his live using his digital human this week.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Well, I see there's still lots of debate to say, will people watch live and stuff? I do think that for people whose businesses might be impacted or might be accelerated by this, I think it's worth understanding more about what are the dynamics shaping life. And some of the AI companies I've seen in China, I mean, it's not the large language model kind of AI companies, but AI companies for building applications for live commerce, they're pretty advanced.
It's interesting. I know there's some degree. I recently got a deck from a founder based in New York, and it's not exactly live, but it's almost live. It's like almost a marketplace platform for you to sell, for basically you doing shows or whatever it is. It could be selling, it could just be talking, it could be teaching or whatever, but like, I think it'd be very interesting. Like, I'd be very curious, you know, maybe a business challenge for you to compare Shenzhen Live to Hangzhou Live to maybe live in US. And maybe you can even develop a program where you meet people in US who want to learn from China and vice versa, or even South Asia to the US. That's another interesting part, because I know we've talked about this before. You're interested in also exploring broader markets in the West. So that might be something interesting, and we could also make some great content around that.
Yeah. Happy to explore. Let me come back to you and the audience of the podcast after I'm back from Hangzhou. But this is springtime. It's very nice. I want to go out.
Oh God, the weather in US before I left was so beautiful. Like, because it was very cold for most of March and April, but then before I left, you could see all the cherry blossoms, and I just missed, you know, having nice different contrasted weather. I'm like sweating.
Like spring and autumn, right?
Yes, correct. Okay, well, it's great catching up, Jiang'an, and we definitely hope to hear from you, from your learnings from Hangzhou, and thanks for sharing, as always.
As a pleasure, as always.
Okay, all right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.